What's up and welcome to the NYC Video Podcast, a show about the film and video industry here in New York and the great people that are making it happen. I'll be your host, Tom Chavez, and each week I'll be talking with other filmmakers to learn more about their craft, process, and share some stories about their careers. On this week's episode, I caught up with Rob LaRosa, a Brooklyn-based sound recordist who I've worked with on a number of interview and branded content shoots throughout the years. Rob is an alumni of Long Island University, and he's also the co-founder of The Majors Productions, a boutique production company that does interview shoots, PSAs, and branded content spots. Throughout the interview, we talk about getting started, finding mentors, buying gear, and a number of other set stories. Let's go ahead and jump into today's interview with Rob LaRosa and learn a little bit about the life and process of a sound recordist and running sound on set. If you're looking for a gourmet kitchen space for your next video production, check out Cooktop Studios, located on the waterfront in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. The space is 3,600 square feet in size, and it gets lots of natural soft light. The kitchen is outfitted with decked and countertops, finished cabinetry, and induction ranges and convection ovens. There is also an ice maker, dishwasher, and multiple refrigerators for your food stylists. Getting to the studio is super easy. It's minutes away from the BQE, subway, bus, or ferry boat. Cooktop also has on-site parking for production vehicles, clients, and crew. To learn more about Cooktop Studio and to see a video walkthrough of the space, visit cooktopstudio.com. Also, be sure to follow them on Instagram to see behind-the-scenes photos that other productions post on social media. I'll leave the links in our show notes. If you end up booking the space, you can get a discount by mentioning the promo code NYC Video Podcast. Happy shooting and bon appetit. Okay, so I have Rob here today on the show. Thanks for being with us, Rob. How are you?
I'm good. How are you today?
I'm good. So yeah, I've worked with you on a few different shoots throughout the years, and I've seen you posting on social media. So I felt like it'd be a good opportunity for me to just ask you some questions as a sound engineer who works here in New York. So first question, which I ask most people, is where are you from and how did you end up in production?
Sure. Thanks for having me. So most of my life I lived in Valley Stream on Long Island. It's in the Nassau County region. And I ended up getting into production sound kind of by accident, really. I originally wanted to be an editor when I was in college. And there was one person in our school who tended to do the sound on everybody's film. And it's not that, and he liked doing it. And he was like, oh, I think I'm going to do this when I graduate, what have you. Fast forward to senior year. And one of my now business partners was doing his thesis near the end of the year. And that guy was not available. So my friend turns to me and says, listen, Rob, you're going to do the sound. And I ask him why. And he says, because so-and-so is not available. And you're also co-producing this film with me. So you got to do it. So I had dabbled and done a couple of shorts here and there where I maybe recorded a little bit of sound more just to help out on set, but I wasn't an expert or anything of that nature. And I wound up recording the sound. And when we edited the film, it sounded better than the sound that the person that was doing sound on everybody's film was. And I thought, this is interesting. And then when but I still didn't think I was going to go into sound. It just was kind of an observation. So after I graduated, I was trying to kind of land a full-time job at a production house, kind of just like as an intern or a production assistant or what have you. And I couldn't really find it. And I wound up meeting someone that kind of needed an assistant editor. And I worked with him and he was asking me, do you do any work on set in other departments? And I told him that I did a little in sound, and he kind of was like, oh, why don't you come on these shoots? I'll teach you some things. So I learned some things. And then my friends from college, we decided to go into business together. And they were like, they knew that I recorded sound here and there. So they basically said, hey, Rob, how about you record sound on our first projects? And I kind of begrudgingly at first said, okay. And I did it. And it turned out pretty well. And I started to think, interesting, maybe this is something I should get into. So as my production company, my friends, as we started to make more and more, mostly at the time, short films, I started to realize that it just didn't make sense for me to continue to just rent stuff from friends and rental houses and to start to buy equipment. So I remember the day I bought the little mixer that was used in my college, which was a Tascam DR680 at the time, mm-hmm. back in 2013. And I bought that and a cheap little Audio Technica mic, and kind of that was the real beginning of my journey.
And I guess, like, so you started buying, like, I guess your own gear as soon as you started out early on. For someone that would be just kind of starting out today, what do you think is like a good basic kit to have just to start out working as a sound engineer and like learning the craft?
Yeah. So I think if for somebody starting out, all you need are the bare essentials, which is a boom pole and a microphone for the boom pole and a mixer recorder, or even just a recorder at the early stages. That's it. There's a lot of other bells and whistles and things you can buy, but that's all that's needed for, I'd say, the very, very bare essentials. Some other people are going to say that you need to buy a couple sets of wireless lavalier mic systems, but I would say that, and I would say that that's not a bad idea either, but in order to just record sound, all you need is a boom and a mixer. So I would say start small and don't buy more than you need. Like, it's very easy to buy, like take out a loan and to buy a lot of equipment, but buy equipment as you need it. Sure. And don't buy more than you need until it's something that's absolutely necessary.
And do you still rent gear as a professional, or do you mostly like just buy it and use your own stuff, or like how does that work as an engineer?
Most of the stuff that I use are things that I've bought and own, but every once in a while there might be a specialty item that I almost never would need. And I will, in those circumstances, have to rent out. Like, just to give a quick example, I tend to not do a ton of jobs recording music, but I had a job back in April where I had to record a 4-piece band and I needed microphone stands, which I currently don't own any of those. So I had to kind of, in a mad dash, because the job kept changing a little bit, I had to go consult my network and find people that had stands. And sure enough, I actually was able to get somebody that had a few, and it worked out. So yeah.
Yeah. When you say network, that's interesting. So do you have like a network of other sound engineers that you kind of like rent or borrow gear from and reciprocate? And like, what's the process, I guess, of getting that done?
Yes. There's definitely a bunch of mixers that I know in the area that will sometimes they'll hit me up and they might need something to supplement their package. And I'll do the same if I need something. It tends to be easier because a rental house closes and they have like dedicated hours, but for all intents and purposes, our store in quotes is always open. So if somebody needs something at 10 o'clock at night, as long as I'm not sleeping and I'm around, I'm happy to lend a piece of gear to a colleague.
Do you have any like rental houses that you deal with specifically or that you've built relationships over the years with?
There's one in particular that fosters great relationships with the sound community, which is Gotham Sound in Astoria, Queens. They, prior to the pandemic, would all the time hold events for mixers to come in. They would have gear swap events where you could bring in your gear and just like trade gear with people. They would have events about proper miking techniques or a workshop for exercises that you could do to kind of stay in proper shape when you're booming on set. And they just kind of, it's just this kind of very, it's a store and they'll do repairs, but also they're totally okay with people just coming in to hang out and talk shop. So it's a very positive, fun environment.
Sure. Yeah. Actually, I heard a interesting thing that, like, I guess during the pandemic, that I think Gotham Sound was the rental house that was being spoken about. The sound engineer mentioned that he was looking into buying some gear, but he was indecisive. So Gotham Sound actually just like rented it to him for free and let him hang on to, I don't know if it was a couple mixers or a couple microphones, just for him to test out, so it would make it easier for him to make a decision. And after a week, he returned it and he ended up buying one of those pieces of gear. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And it seems like they're a really big staple in the sound community here in New York.
Yeah, they're very well known in New York and honestly, even outside of there. There's a couple of very big houses that in various hubs, like there's one called Thai Audio, which I believe is in Florida. There's True Audio, which I think is in Atlanta. And there's a couple of other, there's also Pro Sound in the city, which is another solid rental house. And they're just good vendors too. Like, a lot of the people that own them, they try to stay within, like, in the sound world and amongst the community. So it's not just like, it's not just like you're going to a store to pick up equipment. It's more like yes, you are, but you're also fostering a relationship with somebody at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. And while we're talking gear, because I think we all like to talk gear when we're on film sets, what's your like kit consist of? Like, what kind of gear do you use on a day-to-day basis?
So most days on set, I'm normally working with what's called a basic sound package, which is a boom, a mixer, and two wireless sets. To go into specifics, I'm currently using a Sound Devices 633 mixer recorder, and I use Electrosonic SRC wireless systems with COS 11, that's COS 11 mics. And for my boom, it really depends on the type of situation I'm in, but I own a variety of mics from popular brands, including Shep's and Sennheiser. And outside of the basic package, I also have a lot of extra odds and ends, including something that's commonly referred to as IFBs, although there's a popular brand called Comtex, which you'll see it referred to on set often, something that allows a person to hear the sound. I have 10 of those. I have a timecode slate, like a Denneke timecode slate, and I have Denneke locket boxes, which sends timecode to a camera. I have two of those currently, and just lots of other various cables and odds and ends and things that just make my day on set a little bit easier.
So this isn't gear that you kind of bought all at once. You've just been putting together the perfect package that works for you, I guess, over the course of years.
Yeah, it's definitely, I like to say that it's a continual work in progress, and it's still not done. So I'll buy things that make sense for the time. Sometimes a piece of gear might get a little archaic eventually, and it'll be time to sell it and to move on to something else. Although there's certain things that, like microphones, that we're not necessarily upgrading too often, but some things it makes sense for us to follow the trend, see what new items are coming out. And it's, I like to, with a lot of these things, I like to say it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah.
So, there are people that I know that they graduated and they bought a humongous gear package, but going back to what I was mentioning earlier, I started with a little dinky Tascam DR680. And for probably the first 3 years of my career, that's what I used. I had that. I had this kind of cheap boom pole with an Audio-Technica mic. And then I had one G3 mic set. And I just remember the second day I splurged and bought a second and a third G3 wireless live set. And for me, that was the best day ever, back in maybe after 3 years or so doing this. So it just, you buy stuff that makes sense for you as it all comes in.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but for me, it's a bottomless pit of toys. The second I buy one, I'm really excited about it, and I start using it, something else comes out that I have to spend, a grand or 2 grand on. It's just you can never have enough gear. there's a limited amount of space in people's apartments, but there's never enough gear.
No, it's always a problem. It's a good problem, but it's a problem. It's you get excited about this new equipment, but then you're also oh my God, I just bought the insert piece of equipment here. If only I'd waited. Now I need to buy equipment Y.
Yeah. And is there any piece of non-sound gear that you bring to every shoot that's essential? It's you have to have it.
Well, one thing which I always bring, I don't know if this would be considered sound, but it tends to be something that we'll have, is I always bring a card reader on me that has a bunch of different formats on it. Because sometimes if it's a really small set where it might be, let's say, just me and a DP and a producer on the really small jobs, they might not necessarily have thought of bringing a card reader, and they'll have a computer for when it comes to offloading files. They might not have an SD card slot or something for my CF card. So I need to be prepared to give them something that will allow it to work. The other thing I'll sometimes bring too is, and it's kind of in the same vein, is I'll bring my my laptop with me to some jobs, especially now during the pandemic, because every once in a while they'll need a laptop for a Zoom call. And I've been on one where a computer went down and they wound up needing a computer. So it was luckily I had mine on me. So I don't bring that all the time, but sometimes I won't bring it.
What are some of the paid gigs that you kind of landed early on in your career, and how did you go about finding those clients? How did you get them? Was it through Facebook or through Mandy or what?
A lot of my early jobs were things that kind of, I guess you could say I probably didn't have the most normal career compared to a lot of people that probably got into this, where they probably started as a production assistant for a little bit and kind of built their network that way. I worked only one, the first and only job prior to really getting into sound that I worked on as a production assistant. I actually wound up meeting the sound mixer on there and getting to play around with his gear. And I kind of also knew then, I was like, wow, this is great. I love this. So, I was always kind of around sound even from the start. And a lot of the work came in the way of short films, a lot of student ones or ones that were through he wasn't my business partner at the time, but one of my business partners who knew a few people that he was working with, because he was also a DP just out of college and he was looking to really cut his teeth on film. So he would always try and bring me aboard with him. So we did a lot of short films early on, and I'd be doing like these, they very like low paying kind of things, like practically honestly, like a stipend for some of them back in like 2013, 2014. And that's where I was kind of honing my craft and making mistakes and starting to build my network. Because a lot of this is really like, it's kind of like a snowball effect. As you meet one person, it can lead to the next and lead to the next. Like one of the first people that we met, that we worked with, he wound up, the director wound up having a part-time job, working at the now defunct company Sleepy's, which is now Mattress Firm. And he basically then got myself and my partner to do work, for like Sleepy's corporate end. And we did a lot of stuff for them and, like small, like regional ads and things like that. And again, it was very early on, and there still was a lot that I didn't know. And this is when I would be frequently getting stuff from like rental houses, and I didn't really have much of a network at the time, but as things went on, my network would grow and some of the people that I worked with would grow into other realms. And that's kind of how I would like get into other facets of production outside of the narrative end, like the corporate side or the digital side or like the high end doc side.
Sure. And like, I guess like you mentioned that you had a partner. So tell me about it. I think you have I read somewhere that you have a production company. Like how did that come about?
So I co-own a production company called The Majors Productions. It's myself and three other people. And, the four of us, we're called The Majors Productions because we were all film majors in college together. And also majors is in like the major leagues. So it's like a two part name. And when we graduated, we already knew that we worked well together and we had talked about potentially going into business together. And about half a year or so, almost a year or so after graduating, we decided to make a short film, which I wrote to kind of be sort of like an advertisement, I guess, of our work. Like it was a quick, like 2-day short film, very small budget. And, that we self-funded and we like kept it all internal to friends and stuff like that to make. And, it started doing well in the festival circuit, this little short we did called Return. And after that, a couple years later, we decided to make it official and became an LLC. And I kind of handle like a lot of the producing side and the location sounds for all of our jobs. Another member is, his name is Mark Ryu. He's a DP. He also does gaffing and he does some producing and live stream work. So, and he also handles kind of like some of the financial side. And then, and then we have two creative like producer directors and writers named Nugent Cantolino and Carrie Ferrante, who are like excellent, very creative people. And we'll have them on set as well. It's interesting because like some of us have full-time, some of our members have full-time jobs. Some of us, like myself, are like basically full-time freelance at the company. So it's a very unique situation, but one that makes it very exciting because we never know what's going to happen day to day.
Sure. And what kind of jobs do you like mostly record sound on?
Like in general or just like within the company?
Within the company, like, and also like as a freelancer as well.
Okay, yeah. So within our company, a lot of the work that we've done has been a lot of corporate stuff or just happens to be a lot of work in the nonprofit theater realm. One of our early connections, which was this place called the Tilla Center, which was a part of Long Island University. We did a lot of stuff for them, and that kind of snowballed into other nonprofit theater companies, which unfortunately in the pandemic they haven't been that active, but we kind of do a lot of stuff in that space. And since then though, we've done a lot of a little bit of network TV stuff. We produced a shoot for RuPaul's Drag Race recently. And now we're getting into the live stream space, which has been exciting. As far as like just freelance sound is concerned, a bulk of my work has mainly been before the pandemic. I would say probably almost half of my work was probably like corporate kind of work, like round tables and interviews, but that's kind of died down a lot during recent days. And right now though, and besides that though, I do a lot of network doc work or kind of like BTS things for networks, or a lot of digital ads, which kind of are sometimes commercially, sometimes are not really commercially. They're a little hard to classify, if that makes sense.
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah, kind of like branded content kind of shoots, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Which to me, branded content is sometimes I feel another name for just a commercial, but they don't want to call it one.
For sure.
But sometimes it is a little different from a commercial too.
Yeah, it's a little more like lifestyle-y, I guess. I don't know. It's some people ask me like, how do you define it? And I'm like, I don't really quite know. It's kind of commercially, kind of just interview-based, docy style. Yeah, I don't know. I've actually never looked up branded content. It's something I should do.
Yeah.
But so I think I saw somewhere that you studied at LIU. What did you take away from that program? Did you study like audio engineering in school, or was it film production, or what was the major that you had at school?
So at the school was just the major there was just called general. It was just called film production. It was the Bachelor of Fine Arts in Film Production, where you kind of get like an overview of everything. Eventually we would at the end of our fourth year do a thesis film. And for that kind of the whole point was that you specialize in what you wanted to do. And I initially thought I was going to do mostly picture editing. But I still directed my own thesis and edited it as well. And I still do picture editing, just not as often as I used to. And I do enjoy it. But there wasn't really much in the way of production sound in our school, because it really all came down to who the professors were. And I love all the professors there. It was a great education. But they weren't really audio minded. We had we had a great DP that was there, an amazing writer, prominent film critic, and other people there. But there wasn't much in the way of people that recorded sound. So I can tell you basically this, the education for sound was as follows. We got a worksheet which instructed us how to plug an XLR cable into the school mixer that we had and how to power it on and hit record. That was about it. So pretty much, it became a running joke in our school that most films were going to have pretty bad audio. And that was like it became almost like a drinking game in the school. Like, let's see how many, like we would have a student showcase end of the year. And we were like, let's see how many of them have bad sound. And oftentimes a lot of them would, because there was nobody really to teach you how to do anything. So kind of all of us that did record sound sort of had to figure out trial and error.
Okay. And yeah, that seems kind of like a big trend in a lot of schools, is they focus so much on the image, but they don't really take into account that, like, you know, sound is part of the image. It's half of the image, basically. So yeah, it's interesting that it's not just my school too. Like my school, they did a good amount of sound, but I know that other schools within the CUNY system focus almost solely on camera, and sound is like an afterthought. So it's yeah, definitely something that I think film schools should kind of listen and focus more on. And do you think that the program itself, do you think it prepared you for like a freelance kind of career, or was there still like a lot of stuff that you had to learn after school?
I personally think it set me up for how to conduct myself on a set in terms of what I'd be expecting to see in some of the positions I'd find out. And also just kind of from a like producing standpoint, like what like the flow of a set would be like. In terms of though preparing oneself or making it a career, they didn't really give us too many tools in terms of how, like, where do you find work? How do you get work? on set, it just sort of felt like the only path that I thought about when I got out was I'm going to have to find sites that have full-time job opportunities and try to work at like a production house and get in with them. And then I imagine like I'll get in with this house. I'll find out, I'll like let them know what my specialty is and I'll get in that way. But I quickly found when I graduated that most places wanted either an intern that was still in college or for a beginner's position, they wanted somebody that had 1 to 3 years of experience. So I was kind of like stuck between a rock and a hard place because on the one hand I'm new, but I also wound up working on so many short films that I didn't have time in college to do an internship either. So I never got that experience because a lot of us were under the impression, and we were naive, that if we work on a ton of short films, one of them is going to do really well, get into festivals, and we're going to be noticed. And that's obvious. That's not the reality of how things are. So I don't think that from a business like standpoint, like turning this into a career, I don't think the school fully prepared me for what the realities were going to lie when I got out. But there are plenty of people from my school that are working and they found their path. So I think part of it comes down to the passion you have for this field. And if you do have that passion and you don't give up on it and try to take every path that comes your way, you're going to figure out a way to work in this field.
Sure. So let's say the average person goes to film school, they want to become a sound engineer, they graduate and now they have a diploma. What are the different kind of realms that they can kind of directions that they can go into, whether it's like narrative film or corporate shoots? A sound engineer doesn't just need to work on set. What are some other avenues that they can pursue with a degree in sound?
There's different facets and they're all pretty different. So if let's say hypothetically, you're a very well-rounded person that's familiar with all facets of the sound department, and you're not like me who just does the production sound side, you can get into post sound. So for the editing side, so that could include like creating like sound design, be it sound files that you're creating like Foley, which I do sometimes and it's fun to do. It could be just mixing a film together. So you have all the tracks in a audio like editing software like Pro Tools or Logic. And just editing all of that and trying to sometimes remove sounds like maybe a loud air conditioner or like what you can't deal with on set and other things of that nature. So post is a very big field and that a lot of people go into. Some people go into composing if they like music. That's another area. You can also, if you like more of a live setup, there's live sound engineers. So most of the time when somebody's referred to as an engineer, it's usually in the live setting. The work that I'm usually doing is either referred to as being a production sound mixer or a sound recordist. Cause an engineer generally denotes somebody that's recording something live. Like it could be something as simple as like recording maybe a few people like singing into like a microphone or like a small show, or it could be something as big as like a giant concert, multiple mics on a stage. And on those things, you have a sound engineer on this giant, usually not always giant, but on a board with a ton of inputs and lots of mics going to it. And on the fly, they have more control over, say, someone like myself on set. And then, of course, there's also this kind of falls in the live field, but there's also recording sound in like an AV kind of setting for like corporate conferences and like office meetings and things of that nature. So like a lot of like meetings or maybe like a big, like a live round table or something, something of that nature. Obviously there's not quite as much of that going on right now with COVID, but in normal times you would see events all the time and plenty of sound engineers working steadily. So there's a lot of different avenues that you can go in. And the best part is if you want to focus on one sector, there is plenty of room for growth in that area too.
Sure. And I guess circling back to the beginning of your career, did you have any kind of like mentors that really kind of pushed you in the direction of sound engineering where, you know, they maybe offered you gear for a specific job, or they give you advice, or someone that you continually kind of go back to for any kind of, career advice or anything?
So early on when I started out, I really didn't know anybody. So I was always trying to find people to kind of like figure out like, oh, who works in sound, and just meet people in that facet, because I was very interested in it. And in the Long Island space, there is one person that I did meet who is a big part of at least how I sort of got more into sound and was able to meet other mixers. He's a great location and post mixer named Ken Wilkinson that's based on Long Island. And he did the post sound for a couple of films that I did the picture edit for. And I would go to his studio when he was doing the edits and watch what he was doing. And I wasn't interested in the post sound, but I was telling him what I was into, and he gave me advice, and he actually helped connect me with a few sound groups on various platforms that allowed me to kind of get to know the greater sound community. And from there, I met a bunch of other mixers all over the country, honestly, that were very happy to share advice and really helped me improve from a business standpoint, how to turn this from just a passion into a career. So honestly, like if I was to list every sound mixer that's made a difference in my career, we'd be on here for a very long time.
Another question that I had also is, there's always this kind of like ongoing debate of whether you should specialize in one genre or should you like diversify and like work on several different kinds of projects. There are some, I know, DPs that just do narrative work, and there are some like DPs that just do product photography or music videos. As a sound engineer, do you feel it's important to just specialize and focus on like narratives or documentaries or whatever? Or do you think it's better for your career to kind of do a variety of different kinds of shoots?
I think it depends what world you want to live in. And what I mean by that is there's some mixers that I know that their dream is to be in the union and to be working on big TV shows and feature films. And that is great. And if you want to work in that realm, probably in the narrative side is the right path for that. I know as of now, I don't necessarily really want to be in that realm, because my two cents is if I was in the union, I wouldn't have time for my production company, would have to step down, which I'd rather not do. So it really depends on what type of work you want to focus on. And I think it doesn't hurt to have a variety of jobs that you do, but it's also good to be to have a priority, because there's some mixers that want to mainly work on corporate things, or might be some that want to work on just commercials. And then there's some that love working on just the indie short film most of the time, or like on big features. So I think the question is tailored to it's on a case by case. I would just say that for the average mixer out there, is just to ask themselves what type of job gives you the most passion and makes you excited to wake up each day to show up on set and to record sound. And whatever the answer is for that, that's what you should try to really focus on.
So this is just changing subjects a little bit, but I think it's really important for a lot of freelancers. I know I've dealt with it. I know a bunch of other people who've dealt with it. Have you ever been stiffed by a production, like just not flat out been paid for, you know, the entire job or a portion of the job? And how did you deal with it? Or do you have like any kind of deal memo that you make production sign before engaging with a project?
So I don't have, I guess you could say, a deal memo per se, but what I do have is something called a rate card. So if, let's say, I had a phone call with a prospective client and they booked me, I then will send over this document that I created, which has my booking terms. It lists out gear prices. It lists out my day rate. And it also mentions a lot of things like cancellation policies, or what is my policy when it comes to travel days, or holding on to sound files after job is done. So it kind of is like a de facto deal memo. It's kind of like it's not a signed thing, but it's sort of, these are the terms that like come with booking me. Most of the time it's a non-issue. I just kind of pat it's, if anything, it's more of being sent to sort of confirm a conversation we had. Cause I think it's always important to, when you do get hired for a job, I think it's always important to get it in writing, even if it seems as redundant. It can definitely bite you in the ass if you don't have it done that way. So that's the first part. First part of your question. As far as being stiffed, unfortunately, I'm currently in a, I'm currently dealing with two situations that I've been in since 2019, September 2019 and November 2019, respectively, of jobs that I am still owed money. One of them is a short film that I did in the city for 2 days, and I worked with the guy in August, and it was a very difficult ordeal. And I should have probably, when he came back around, should have said no immediately, because it really was a pain. Now, granted, I was paid in August, but for some reason I said yes. And I've been trying since then to get paid for the work. And it's been pretty rough. Without getting into the whole story, it's gotten to the point that I feel that he tells me to show up at his office to pick up a check. But I'll be honest with you, I'm worried that if I show up to the office to pick up the check, that this person may try to do bodily harm to me. It's, wow. I know that's like really extreme, but that's kind of the vibes I get from this person.
Wow.
So I might just kind of let that die, because it's not a ton of money, but it's, again, obviously the principle, you worked for the job, you should be paid for your time.
Absolutely.
The other one is a lot more money, but It was a corporate shoot I did where the guy was nice. The job was great. I brought on one of my my friends who's a DP on Long Island. I brought him on, and we did a 3 days, and everything was great. Like, the shoot went well, went excellent. We sent our invoices in and everything. But then over time, like, we didn't get payment, and we would follow up with him. And he then was like, the guy was giving us kind of like all these reasons he couldn't pass, in saying that like he had a major surgery that happened, and then he was having issues. He like lost, was losing it, had to sell his house. And then the pandemic happened, and that made it harder. And I will say, to the guy's credit, he has since then paid me a little bit of what's owed. So I'm hopeful that I will get paid for that one. But the other one, the short film that I did, that one, I think I have to just kind of cut my losses. So it's unfortunate, but it happens.
Yeah, I think it's really important what you mentioned about getting everything in writing. I've been doing this now for like 13 years or so, or 14 years, and I've only had to go to court 3 times. But every single time I've gone, the early years that I was operating, I didn't have a contract. I didn't have any kind of deal memo, but I made sure that everything was clean cut in either an email or text message. And both times, I always had to print out. When I showed up to small claims court, I printed out my emails. I printed out the screenshots that I took my phone and emailed to myself and printed those out. And within a couple minutes, it was just an open and shut case. I won all 3 cases because I had everything in writing. And I'll never forget, like, the first time actually I went to court, the judge said, like, you know, the award goes to Tom Chavez. And he turned to me, he's like, next time, make sure you have a contract. And like an idiot, I still didn't, it took me a couple more years to actually flesh out a proper contract. But having all that stuff in writing has saved me every single time. So I heard an interview with another sound engineer here in New York, and he had mentioned that a production had stiffed him on an Uber rides over the course of, I think, a week or a 2 week job. He had accrued about $400 or $500 in Ubers because, you know, obviously sound engineers, they have a bunch of Pelican cases and they can't schlep those onto the train very easily. So a lot of productions will say that they'll cover transportation to set. Unfortunately, this sound engineer did not get that in writing per se. And at the end of the job, they cut him a check minus the Uber rides. And he was out like $400 or $500. And when he followed up with them, they said, well, you know, we don't have anything in writing. Can you prove it to us? And it became a big thing. And same thing, he had to chalk it up as a loss because he didn't want to rock the boat too much. You know, this person that paid him, he wants to continue that relationship professionally and at least get more work in the future. Said he didn't want to make a big stink about it, but he said moving forward, he was adding that to his rate card, is making sure that productions know all of the expenses that come along with hiring me. It's not just me showing up with gear, but, you know, like you said, if you have any cancellation days or kill fees or transportation and stuff like that, that's good to just have in writing to be able to show the producer, have them understand what goes along with it. So God forbid you have to go to court, at least you have everything in writing and you can submit it to a judge, and it'll be an open and shut case.
Yeah, it's so important. It's so important. And that story that you said about the Ubers is huge too, just because when we're talking like the travel expenses for somebody like yourself or myself or somebody else that owns gear, it's not like some positions where all you need to show up the set is yourself and you might not necessarily have your travel costs covered. But for us, because we're owner operators, if we're doing something in the city, we're usually having our parking, maybe our tolls, depending, covered. And then for me, when I'm doing stuff outside of the five boroughs, I'm usually having, in addition to the parking if necessary, depending on the location, I'm usually always having my mileage covered at the IRS rate and then any tolls that I incur through my time. So it's easy, like when you're newer in the field, it's easy to think, well, that's not too bad. Like, how much could that be? But when you add up, like just last week, I did a job in Trenton, New Jersey. And to go from New York to Trenton, which was about 2 hours and like maybe 20 minutes or so, and back, I racked up almost $49 in tolls. And you're not going to think about that until, like, you might be like, oh, well, how much could the tolls really be? But there's so much depending on the routes you go, and the mileage alone costs well over $100 for everything. So just like all this stuff, it adds up a lot. And that's why I'm always very upfront when I'm booking with a client. Obviously there's my day rate, there's my gear rental, but I make sure that these travel things are also part of it. And I'm not going to lie to you, I've had a couple of jobs that were basically willing to pay me my price, but they were asking me to work like 2.5 hours or so outside of where I'm at, where I am. And they refused to pay for any travel. And I would turn those gigs down because in those situations, I'd be losing sometimes like a couple $100, like $200 to $300 just on the travel.
Yeah, I've always found that that's kind of like a gray area. Like, how do you charge accordingly? And I think I've asked this question a couple times in forums, and I've gotten mixed answers from different people in different departments. Like, for example, if you're doing a job, like you said, in Trenton, and you live in Brooklyn, where most, I think, filmmakers in New York live, how do you charge for that? Because if the production's on like a 10-hour day or a 12-hour day, does that include 2 hours of travel, like to and from set, which would be a total of 4 hours, or is it from? Yeah, so that to me has always been gray. Do you know, I guess, what the proper way to charge for that stuff is?
Yeah, no. So what I do, and I can, at least speaking for a lot of the colleagues I know, what many, at least in sound, will do is, because again, we're traveling with our gear and everything. If we're doing a job in New York City, that's obviously local to where we are. So we kind of usually don't worry about those. Like there's no real mileage or anything like that being covered, because again, we're local to that vicinity. But if, again, like in the case of Trenton, because it's so far of a trip, and like there aren't a lot of people that are like local to that area, and they're obviously using us because they want us on set, I do ask for travel time, or the technical term, as I've learned, is portal to portal. So I will ask for that for like a 10-hour day. And sometimes it works out well in that, for now, granted, every department is a little different. And sometimes for sound, we're not needed as long on set as others. If, say, it's just like an interview or something, or like maybe it's an event that's only going to take like 2 hours to do and then it's done. But I've had plenty of days where, like, traveling to like Trenton, and like it might be like 4 hours on the road, and then they have me for 6 hours on set. And if it winds up going over, then at least it's known ahead of time, hey, we might go overtime a little bit. And a lot of productions usually, at least I feel, if you make this known ahead of time, then they respect that. And I've usually had very little in the way of pushback to that. But this isn't really something you can't, like, book a job and then show up. Let's say the job is 2 hours away or something, and then show up and then say, and then on the invoice tack on that your travel time was on the clock, because it's just like negotiating your labor and your gear, it's something that you have to discuss ahead of time. And I actually like to use Portal to Portal as a negotiating tool too. So like, let's say somebody's coming in on the low side, I'll mention, well, listen, like you're telling me that the shoot is going to be in a quote unquote half day, but with Portal to Portal, it's going to actually be more like a 10, 11 hour day. So, so we need to like kind of discuss that a little bit. And sometimes it then works in your favor if you are able to kind of, it's definitely turned the tide of a lot of jobs where then they realize, okay, yeah, it's a lot to travel. It's a lot of time. And, sometimes I like to say sometimes we win and sometimes we lose, but I'm not afraid to, lose the job because in this case, they're reaching out to me. So they wanted me for whatever reason, whether they heard about me or they like me. And if we can't come to an agreement, that's okay. There's going to be other jobs that I'm going to work and, I'll live to see another day. So I'm not afraid to stand up for myself for some of these terms to a point.
Yeah, that's definitely an ongoing theme and thing, you know, every freelancer deals with is being able to know what your limit is and walk away from a job. Sometimes it's just not worth it. Sometimes if they're nickel and diming you about really like minor things early on, that could be a telltale sign of greater headaches that are going to, you know, show up around hour 10, hour 11, hour 12, and it's going to snowball into just a lot more of a bigger issue. So sometimes, yeah, you do need to just be able to know what you're worth and walk away from certain jobs. Yeah,
exactly.
So while we're on such a down kind of subject, let's talk about worst experiences ever on set. What's the worst thing that you've ever kind of had happen on set, whether it was something you forgot something or something that just went wrong or went sideways on a production? And what did you learn from that experience?
Oh my goodness. This is such a hard question. Cause like I can tell you a story for like my worst experience on a narrative set, my worst experience on a corporate set, my worst experience on like a live kind of set where I was still like mixing. They're all like, and they all run the gamut in different ways. But I'll tell you a story for, I think the best one I could tell you, because I'll preface this story, actually, it made me question whether I should even stay in this field. I considered leaving the field because of this job.
Wow.
That's how bad it was. So I want to say early 2017, late 2016, a colleague of mine referred me to a job for this small nonprofit that was putting together a short film. And, I spoke to the DP, he was very nice and everything. And he sends me the script and it's like a 43 page script. And then I get the news that this apparently 43 page script is supposed to be shot in 2 days, maybe a third day.
Wow.
Maybe a third day. Okay. So I was already very on edge about this. I was like, and there was a lot of locations, a lot of actors. So I was very wary. So the first day on the set, when I showed up, we do the first scene, it's going fine. We're getting around to our lunch break and we were going to have Chinese food. And when the Chinese food arrived, before we were going to break for lunch, and the director slash producer who had only prior to this produced one other short for like her nonprofit, she said, "No, no, no, guys, you can't eat. We need to use the Chinese food as a prop for the actors." And we were like, "What? Come again?" They're like, "Yeah, in the scene, the characters are going to be eating, and we need to have them bring in the bag of the Chinese food. And then we need them to be able to like eat their food in the scene." And thankfully the DP put his foot down and was like, "The crew's breaking. We're not going to tolerate this." And we ate, but the saddest part was that the actors had to wait to eat their food because the director was insistent that they use that food for the scene. Oh, so the actors are there waiting as we're for 30 minutes eating our Chinese food. Then we get off the break. Then we set up for the next scene, which takes another half hour. And then they finally get to eat this by this point, cold Chinese food. And they had to only eat it in bits for the scenes. So they couldn't actually like really eat a lot of it at a time. Cause they had to like try to match their movements.
Yeah.
And that, like, that kind of set the tone for the entire shoot. Then, like, after that, we had by later in the day, there was kind of a second cam op slash gaffer. The DP was like, forget about the lights for the rest of the shoot. We're just using natural lighting for everything because there was no time. And then we would have scenes that were like there was like one scene that was like 7 pages, and you had all these actors that didn't know their lines. Granted, it was a 43-page script, so I can't fully fault them there. But they would be like, they'd have the scripts underneath them on a table, and they'd be looking down, and we'd record these like 15-minute takes where they would like kind of do the whole scene in one shot of their angle. And it was brutal.
I've definitely been on those, and that's what we call a shit show in the industry.
Oh, yeah. It was a huge one, yeah.
All right, man. Well, listen, I've got one more question for you, and it's just like, it's a burning question that I've wondered for years, and I think a lot of people may have the same question, but how do boom operators hold a boom over their head for like 10 minutes at a time? It's crazy. I have no idea how you guys do that.
So as I come to find, holding the boom over our heads is actually not the right way for us to hold it. Now, granted, yes, when you see lots of behind the scenes things and pictures, you will see shots where that happens. And there are times where you do have to hold the mic very high. But the proper technique is you don't want to extend your arms up above your head all the time, because what's going to happen is your arms are going to fatigue. And I would just say, like, anybody, even somebody listening to this podcast right now, just try for like a minute raising both of your hands in the air. You don't have to hold anything. Just raise them in the air and keep them there for a minute and see how they feel when that minute is done. I can almost guarantee you that they're going to feel really shot and tired. And it has nothing to do with weight. It's just keeping them in that one position. So what I've learned from some other boom ops, including some that are in the union, there's one very prominent boom op named Ken Strain, who actually has like a little masterclass kind of for it. I've learned from him that a good way to hold the boom is you want to try to keep it kind of at shoulder length. So meaning you want to have your arms low. Obviously you want the boom pointed up and above the camera lens, but you want to have it in such a way that you can either use your kind of keep your shoulders low. So that way you're not raising your shoulders, your arms are holding it, but you're kind of tilting it up. If that makes sense. Using things as kind of a wedge sometimes, like when I'm recording sound and if I don't have a boom operator on set, I'll sometimes use my mixer bag as kind of a, I guess like a fulcrum for my elbow, and I'll rest my elbow in there. That way the brunt of the weight is being taken by the bag and not my arms. So I'm able to save on kind of fatigue, and it's especially on like when you're working on like kind of a docu style shoot where maybe you're running around with like talent and you're filming kind of on the fly. All it takes is like 20 minutes of holding that boom over your head and you're going to be shot. So you have to sometimes develop other techniques when unfortunately production does not have the budget or for a boom op or an audio assistant, as it's commonly referred.
Yeah, I've done it before on these, like, you know, like especially like early on in my career, like when I was doing these short films and everyone was wearing multiple hats, and I would hold the thing for like 30 seconds and my arms would start shaking, my shoulders would start to burn. By take three, I was like, screw this, I'm not doing this anymore. someone else has got to do this because I can't do it. It's tough.
Yeah, and what happens is, unfortunately, there's been some more veteran mixers that I've met that have had to. Because there was no one really to show them the proper technique. Everybody just assumed to always do it this way, that they'd wind up needing to get usually like a shoulder cuff surgery, which everybody told me you don't want to get that. And it's apparently like a big procedure, and your arms, I mean, it helps your arms, but it's never fully the same after that. So that's why I always like to tell people, like, it's great. Obviously, we love to work, but we always want it to be safe, and that includes like department specific things like holding a boom. Like just to give a quick, if I may, like a quick anecdotal thing. I got asked to do like a docu style shoot, and was told that there might be two people on camera talking for an hour or so at a dining room table. And I asked them, do we know for sure they're going to be sitting there? And they said, there's a chance, but we'll know later. And I said, okay, the reason I ask is because I'd rather not boom for an hour with these talent. I don't know what the frame's going to be and how high I'm going to have my hands up. And it's not that I want to be lazy. It's I have to think about my health, and I'd much rather have two booms on a stand set up. That way I can rest my arms and also give you clean audio.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think that's an out of the ordinary request to not have to hold a boom over a dining table. Yeah, those kinds of scenes, I'm always like blown away by how some dudes can do it no problem. I know that I couldn't, but yeah, it's gotta be hard. Is there any kind of like easy rig kind of thing for booms where like two arms that kind of take the weight of the boom that you can still flex without keeping your hands up?
I've been seeing some these like exoskeleton type of deals that like that if they're very like I feel more in like prototypes, but it's kind of like they kind of attach to your shoulders. And I don't know fully how they work. I'll be honest, I haven't really fully investigated it, but I've seen some videos of like boom ops and these like kind of like exoskeleton contraptions. And apparently it takes a lot of the weight off of your shoulders by wearing them. Yeah. But this is something that would specifically be for like a boom operator. You wouldn't be able to wear it for like a sound mixer that's on set also wearing a mixing bag harness. Right. It would have to be for like a set where you have a boom op that was hired on as well.
Yeah. I mean, like I imagine like shooting like a documentary with like NBA players must be so hard because those guys are like 7 foot.
Oh my God. Yeah. No, I mean, it also honestly, it really sometimes comes down to the amount of headroom. The closer that you can be so that there's not a ton of headroom, the easier it is for us on those days where we have to be very agile on our feet and boom, because then we can keep our arms a little bit lower and save our strength. And then if we have a moment here and there where we have to have our arms raised for a couple of minutes, we'll be ready for it. But if the whole time it's like the camera's going wide and tight suddenly, and there's no rhyme or reason, even if the sound is good, it puts us through the paces and it could potentially be a little bit dangerous too, depending on how long they're asking us to do it for. But the thing is, that's the average, I feel producer is not going to think about that. They'll think about safety, but they won't think about that specific aspect. And I wish more productions really put that into consideration when it comes to like the creative side of how a shot's going to be set up.
Yeah, I think it's a good balance of like thinking about safety, thinking about how to technically achieve something, but also looking at it realistically. Like a human being has to do this. Is it going to take a toll on their body? And if so, how much can they endure? And how much is just, you know, insanity? You can't ask someone to do that for, you know, for too long. So I think it also falls on us too, as owner operators and as technicians who are going to be performing the work. We have to be upfront about that and let producers know ahead of time, like, this is a potential problem. We should think about it like this. Maybe we can approach it like that. So yeah, I think being vocal early on in the process of pre-production to sort out those problems and figure out if there's another way to do it and still get the same effect that you're chasing after, you know?
Yeah. I think it's very key. Like sometimes in a lot of the pre-production that sound won't always be looped in, even if it's something that seems simple, like an interview shoot. I definitely like to be part of that conversation from the beginning, because sometimes, again, the creative side might be very, like, it might be an interview shoot, but there's so many aspects, like what type of space are you filming in? What were you thinking about as far as framing is concerned? What is the talent going to be wearing? There's a lot of stuff that if we could show up to set not knowing, but, I'd rather have all that information than not have it. So I think sometimes it's kind of taken for granted about having us as a part of the pre-production process, but I think it can be insurmountable even on a job that is quote unquote easy.
Yeah. According to producers, every job I've ever done is easy, because that's how the conversation starts. Hey, I've got an easy job here. It's going to be walk in the park. And then it's, you know, very rare that it actually is an easy job. More often than not, it requires a lot more work than they can imagine.
Those are almost always the hardest ones. And I used to say, oh, this is going to be an easy shoot. And that's when I've completely screwed myself. And from now on, like since then, I don't say it's going to be an easy day or a hard day. I just say today is going to be a day.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
And yeah.
Okay, well, that's all I got for you today, man. If the listeners wanted to try to find you online, what's the best way to find you?
So the best way that they could reach me is they could follow me on Instagram at Bobby the Pink. That's BobbyTheHePink. Or they can check out my company's website, which is themajorsproductions.com. We have a Facebook page too, which is also just called The Majors Productions if they search it on there. And they could email me there or contact me on Instagram.
Beautiful. All right. Well, cool, man. I'll definitely drop those in the show notes so people can find you if they weren't able to catch it in the audios. So, okay, man. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. You answered a bunch of questions that I had no idea, and hopefully our listeners didn't have any understanding really of the sound process. So hopefully they're a little bit more informed and will know how to work with their sound recordists and boom operators in the future.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
This week's episode is sponsored by my lighting company, MasterShot Films. Since 2008, thousands of productions have entrusted the MasterShot team to deliver and operate all of the lighting equipment for their interviews, branded content, and social media videos. Our gaffers and key grips deliver anywhere in the tri-state area. Visit MasterShotFilms.com to see a virtual tour of our G&E vans and to see some BTS videos of our lighting setups that we've lit over the years. Save 10% on your first booking by using the promo code NYCVideoPodcast.
Okay, so I just wanted to say thank you again to Rob for having taken the time to share all of these stories with our community. Rob is always a pleasure to work with, so be sure to follow him on Instagram to keep up with his work. And if you're looking for a great sound mixer for your next production, I'll be sure to leave his contact info in the show notes. So that just about wraps up today's show. Be sure to subscribe in order to be alerted every time we put out a new episode, where we'll be interviewing other working professionals here in New York. If you have questions or themes you'd like us to explore on the show, shoot us a DM on Instagram at NYCVideoPodcast. If you're interested in running a sponsored ad on the show, please send us an email at nycvideopodcast@gmail.com and we'll send you some more information. Until next week, I'm Tom Chavez, and you've been listening to the NYC Video Podcast. I'll see you on set.